Hi, and welcome to Black All Year, the podcast that explores what it means to center blackness in conversations that matter every month of the year. I'm Steffa Doucet, and in this episode, we're diving into the critical issue of bias within healthcare with special guest Dr. Tina Seeker. From unequal treatment to systemic inequalities, we're going to unpack how racism and unconscious bias continue to shape medical practice and patient outcomes. Dr. Tina Seeker is Reader in Technoscience and Intersectional Justice in the School of Arts and Culture at Newcastle University. Her interdisciplinary research focuses on race, gender, science, and health. With a background in both media studies and the social science, Dr. Seeker brings a sharp and thoughtful lens to the structural forces that influence healthcare delivery. Her work is committed to justice, equity, and deep institutional change. So hi, Tina. I'm really delighted that you could be on the show, and this is a topic I've been wanting to discuss for a long time. But it would be great if you could start just by introducing yourself.
My name is Dr. Tina Seeker. I'm a reader in technoscience and intersectional justice in the School of Arts and Culture at Newcastle University. I do work around critical science studies, looking at health and the environment. And then I also do work on gender-based violence and restorative justice. So that kind of a bridge between the two different areas. I'm Canadian, but I've been here since 2017.
And I mean, when you said your title there, and I thought, to be honest, for somebody who doesn't understand the world or that you work in, that's a lot of words that will mean a great deal. So can you explain a little bit more about what it actually is that you look at?
Yeah, so I look at how science and technology and the way that we usually understand it sort of, you know, focuses on, you know, science is objective and it is rational and there's no values in there. And so my approach and what I do is sort of take the philosophy of science and technology and the sociology of science and technology and look at what are the values, the implications, the consequences of the technologies we use and the science we practice. So I sort of go through and kind of pull out, you know, how does this scientific practice and this technology impact people who are most marginalized? And so that's where the intersectional stuff comes in. So looking at how people who are multiply marginalized along the axes of gender, race, class, sexuality, disability, how the kinds of technologies that we use, whether it's in health or the environment, impact those populations sometimes in ways that we don't necessarily see in the first instance.
Really interesting stuff. And I loved what you said there about we do tend to have this view of science, isn't it, that it's quite cold and clinical, and therefore it's kind of fact-based. So it's either right or wrong, and there's no judgment that comes into the general population. It's that kind of, well, it's not a judgment thing. So then when people use science sometimes to back up their arguments and opinions, they don't recognize that there are biases that are brought into drawing those judgments from science. It's not quite as straightforward as right or wrong, is it?
Yeah, and it's really difficult because you get in a bit of a double bind because you want to say that, you know, science is based on trial and error. And when things change and we learn new things, our consensus shifts. Mm-hmm. But you also don't want to leave room open for skepticism that, you know, science is just a bunch of guesses. And it really isn't. It is based on kind of informed community consensus of scientists coming together and say, you know, with the facts that we have now, this is what we can say about, you know, climate change. But then being, you know, the fact that we have approached science in the past as saying that it is infallible leaves us open to, you know, saying that, oh, it's, you know, entirely unreal.
Yeah. And I know my other half is a scientist by background, and he was talking the other day about mammoths and the skulls of mammoths, and actually that there's a
there's a thought that that's where the whole concept of a cyclops came from, because people found the skulls of mammoths and they've got this great big huge hole in the center of their heads. Mm-hmm. People assumed that that was an eye socket. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's actually where the trunks were. But because that was the belief, it was kind of, oh, well, what holes do skulls have? It's for their eyes, and therefore that must be what it is. That means it was a creature, a big creature that had one eye. Mm-hmm. And I think because there were no contrary views there, that became the accepted kind of norm. And is that one of the things that you find in your work, that perhaps particularly in the past, the people who have been the authorities on the science have tended to be from one group, and let's not beat around the bush, what they've been tended to be white men.
Yeah.
And therefore the beliefs and the value sets and things that they've brought to their research has perhaps not been as robust as it might be or be becoming now. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so, because when we think about, you know, when scientists decide what are the questions we need to ask and what are the methods we're going to apply, there are choices that are made. And if your choices that you're making is based on the assumption of, you know, your particular experience and, you know, your community's experience, you will tend to make those decisions that align with those groups. So you don't think about, you know, how is this going to impact another group of, you know, racialized women or people who are disabled. That just doesn't come, you know, to your mind. And it's not necessarily nefarious or there's ill intent, although there are examples of that as well. But it really is that the structures of science are set up in a way that these are just the questions that are asked over and over again. So it can be something as, you know, just general as, you know, when seatbelts are designed and the, you know, the prototypes and the people that they use to test it are white men, because that's the default. So it means that, you know, people who are disabled, women, you know, in particular, they weren't sort of built into the entire process of testing. And so, you know, women's deaths with the airbags and everything are disproportionately higher. And so it's not that they intentionally didn't think about women, but science is set up such that didn't even come, you know, to their mind. And it's kind of looking at those structures of scientific practices and say that, you know, how can we make science more inclusive and more robust? Because we think that in doing so and looking at science from these different perspectives, that we can get better science. That is more just, and that is going to be better for the majority of people.
Yeah, and I loved what you said there about it's sometimes about the questions that you ask. So I think those of us that discovered this are quite astounded by the fact that period products were only started to be tested with blood last year, mm-hmm. and it was water or saline beforehand. And so the absorbency is completely different between saline and blood. Now, when I heard that, it was kind of one of those moments where I went, sorry, what? You did what? Because actually, to anybody who's had to use period products, you kind of know that they're not the same thing. And you just assume that, yes, on adverts, they use that blue water, but that wouldn't be what they were tested on. But because of who was involved in it at the time, it obviously just, they didn't go, oh, well, actually, maybe we should use the actual product that this is going to be used for rather than something that's a poor imitation.
Yeah, and it's the same thing for even doses of medication. You know, I think that that's another issue that just isn't considered. And, you know, for things like vaccinations, there were examples of, you know, women who identify as fat, that the dosage should have been, you know, of different vaccines or different medications should have been adjusted based on body size, but that just wasn't considered because that's not the default person that you're testing on.
So really interesting stuff. And as I said, I've wanted to talk about that interrelationship between health and ethnicity for quite some time. We've had various episodes that have touched on that. So we've talked about maternal mortality and the fact that you're four times more likely now in the UK to die if you are Black, and have increased risk of mortality if you are South Asian and the like. We've talked about things like the different approaches to pain management and to child mortality. So it's come up quite a bit in various episodes. But I think when we were talking, I got quite excited about the fact that this is an area of research and work that you do. And mm-hmm. thought, right, let's, of all the multitude of things that we could talk about, we may well do in the future, this would be a really great topic for us to talk about. So talk to me a little bit about some of the work that you've been doing in that area.
Yeah, the most recent one that I think will be applicable is the work around the pulse oximeter that I was doing, where the pulse oximeter, which you put on your finger, you usually would go to the hospital and they would do, and it would test the concentration of oxygen in your blood. And they would be able to sort of say, okay, if it's dipped below a certain level, that we need to take action. And during the height of COVID, hospitals were giving sort of these portable ones to patients to take home. And they would say, okay, when your blood oxygen level reaches a certain amount, a certain level, you know, come to the hospital. And the kind of infrared part of it refracts off of your skin. And they found that it had only been tested on white skin. So it was giving patients with darker skin a time to go to the hospital that was much later, and sometimes it was too late. And so that idea of how, you know, these technologies are racialized, they're raced technologies. And what I was really interested in is how to think about health disparities through the lens of inequality, and doing it in a way that didn't kind of make race concrete. So this idea that race is socially constructed, there's no genes for race, you know, it's not genetic. It is a way that we hierarchically decided to differentiate between people and then assign certain characteristics to certain groups in an arbitrary way. There's nothing, you know, to say that we couldn't have done that for eye color, you know, and decided that people with green eyes were the best. And so here we have an example of skin being a critical part in how the differentiations are being made in a way that I thought was really interesting. But I think what I was trying to do in the article and in the book chapter is to make the argument that these differential health outcomes are not because of some kind of inherent characteristic. It is because society has been structured in a way that those people who identify as racialized have grown up in circumstances that have put them at risk. And so, you know, environmental racism, poverty, lack of access to education. And that is why we have high maternal mortality amongst Black women, not because they are Black, but because their sort of perceived Blackness has led to their being disproportionately affected by, you know, a lack of access that has started since colonialism and, you know, slavery and all the way to now, that have put them at a level that is more difficult to get out of.
Yeah. And it sounds almost like there's, I think, three kind of levels of this. So there's the, because of the color of your skin, you may have some technical issues that have been designed into that technology that means it won't actually work as well for you. So I'm really aware, like you say, there's things like that pulse oximeter, but there are other devices that have been designed that just don't work as well on darker skin. So there's that. There's then the kind of those environmental factors that mean that actually in the world generally, but particularly in what we would call the developed world, an awful phrase, but in kind of the Western world, if you are ethnically minoritized, you are more likely to be living in poorer conditions and therefore be exposed more to all of those conditions. And then there's bias. And there's the kind of the clinical bias that then comes into it. That, I mean, I remember it was a good few years ago, but not, well, obviously within my working memory, being told by a surgeon that black and Asian, South Asian vessels, veins and arteries were narrower. And that was why we were more likely to have heart disease, which is just not true. Genetically, there is nothing to back that up. That whole thing of actually that the pain threshold is different, particularly for black women, is still something that is generally held. And there's lots of stuff that either is still in textbooks or has only recently been taken out of textbooks that actually is actually completely untrue, isn't it? So, yeah. So we've got kind of three levels of things that mean that if you are black or brown, there is a less, or there is more likelihood that the care that you're going to get is worse, and that then leads to worse outcomes.
Yeah, that is absolutely the case. And I think that argument has been made as well, because if you are getting a kind of care that is of that nature, that is so distorted and sometimes hostile, then you are less likely to go to get care when you need it. And so sometimes you go too late and then you have worse health outcomes. So it's not because you are genetically predisposed to bad health outcomes, but it's because you have delayed going to get medical care because it's just not somewhere that you feel comfortable in. And I think that can go from people who are sexually minoritized as well, people who are disabled as well. I do some work around racialized fat women who are trying to get care during COVID, and particularly for long COVID symptoms. And they would be just, you know, time after time, these experiences of going and saying that, you know, I've got these symptoms, and I think it's because of COVID, and being told that, oh, you just need to lose weight. And it was that kind of thing where, you know, it could have been something that was just unrelated to weight at all. And being told that, you know, you're just not being taken seriously. And then in the intersectionality part of it, it's worse for, you know, fat women of color, because all of those multiplying layers means that you are even less likely to get the care that you need.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. It is absolutely that kind of that layering of biases and blocks that then mean that you get further and further away from the care that would be experienced by, I'm going to keep saying the white man, but and I know some white men get very touchy about this, but actually, I think the term you use is they are the default, aren't they? In health generally, they are the default. Even when it's stuff that doesn't really affect them at all.
Yeah. And I think it's also, you know, to kind of say that it's difficult to people sort of have this sense that it is not, you know, an individual person that is just being mean necessarily. It is sort of all the incentives, the entire structure is built up on this belief. So, you know, that is what the outcome is going to be. And I think that's when we talk about structural racism, that's what we're talking about, is, you know, moving it away from, you know, a face-to-face act of discrimination, which happens, but to say that there are larger ways in which race is structurally built into a system and it's perpetuated. And that is why there are negative outcomes for racialized groups, not because there's something inherent in those groups that makes them more susceptible. It's that that susceptibility has been built in to the system.
Yeah. And one of the examples that's really kind of working my system at the moment, and probably because it applies to me, and it's interesting that you talked about overweight women. So I have put on some weight over the last year or so. And I'm trying to get back to a healthy weight. And we use BMI as that indicator of weight. Now, the NHS BMI calculator tells me, it asks me what my ethnicity is. Mm-hmm. So I played with it. If I say that I'm white, I have lost a bit of weight, so we'll go back to the beginning. But if I said I was white, I was overweight. if I said I was mixed heritage or Black or South Asian, because I played around with it, I was obese. I was clinically obese, purely and simply because of the color of my skin. And that infuriated me because, as you say, the fact that I'm obese then leads people to make judgments about other things. Mm-hmm. And about what I need to do. So if I then had an associated health issue, they would immediately attribute that to my obesity rather than something else. And the justification for this that they give is that if you are of Black, African, Caribbean, or of South Asian heritage, you are more likely to have things like diabetes and heart disease. But going back to what you were saying there, there's no recognition of any other socioeconomic factors in that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's purely about your ethnicity.
And it's this idea that you know, that it is your race that makes you susceptible. It's no, the risk has been manufactured along racial lines. And so that is the big issue. And yeah, BMI, I mean, BMI was, you know, it was created in the like mid-1800s. By an insurance company to sort of look at how to not insure people or sort of have a demarcation. It was not meant to be, you know, a way to gauge health. And the idea that, you know, it doesn't take into consideration like muscle mass, the fact that, you know, being overweight actually makes you more likely to have a longer lifespan than being very thin. So for example, for myself, someone who maybe has 30 pounds on me would likely have a longer lifespan than I would, but the health system says that I'm healthier, which is just absolutely ridiculous, you know? And I think like BMI is just, you know, an awful kind of, you know, and the idea of also like, how are we defining health? You know, we're defining health as like an individual attribute. But health is a systemic thing. It is a community thing. It is, you know, it's related to stress. It's related to access to healthy food, to spaces for leisure, to education, to housing. And so, you know, instead of telling someone eat less, you know, McDonald's or something, if you said, I'm going to give this person access to housing that is not always at risk. And that is probably going to do a lot more than not having a burger once or twice, right? And so it's that kind of idea that, yeah. And I think that we have, you know, in terms of the way we think about health subjectivities and in terms of femininity and bodies, that it is also just entirely connected to capitalism, consumption, consumerism. And so we have what are really arbitrary ideals about what health is. It's not you are healthy or unhealthy. It's that is being mapped onto a very Western idea of what health looks like as well. Yeah. And so that's why you can go in and, you know, say to someone that they look really good or really healthy, or they lost 10 pounds. And, you know, then they tell you that, you know, I've been sick for 6 weeks. And so we have this sense that, you know, weight is an indicator of health. And that's not the case.
Yeah. And actually, interestingly, I think in the Western world, weight is an indicator of wealth as well, in a contrary way to the way it is in kind of the Southern Hemisphere in particular, in that if I think about Ghana, the wealthier you are, the bigger you are. Whereas here, it's very much the opposite to that. And being slim is seen as being wealthy and educated. It's a really interesting contrast there. I'm interested as well, just around that whole idea of the kind of experiences that we have belonging to various and intersecting minoritized groups, and the impact that that has on our well-being in terms of just the daily stress. And I was talking to somebody the other day about it, and I said, it's just sometimes you just want to have a break. You just want to not have to worry about some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And yet our reality is it's always there. and the pressure that that puts on our physiology and the pressures that can, the problems that can come from that.
Yeah. And there's a term for it. It's called racial weathering, that the daily experiences of microaggressions and systemic racism has a weathering effect on the body. So it actually leads to ill health, that racism is a risk factor of ill health, of hypertension, of, you know, high blood pressure, of diabetes, that perhaps that should be a risk factor, that it is the racism that's doing a lot of these. And there's sociological and also medical tests of this, sort of looking at like the telomeres, genetically of racialized groups, and kind of the ways and connecting it to systemic racism and microaggressions on a day-to-day level. That kind of constant weathering, I think, you know, is a risk factor for health.
So I'm really fascinated. I'm sitting listening to you and very much agreeing with what you're saying. But I'm also thinking, so what do we do about it? Is there stuff that's going on that actually takes the learning and research that people like you are doing and pushes that through into medical training and beyond, actually, because this isn't just about doctors and nurses and the like. It is about the system. But how's that work being taken and interpreted to help improve things?
Yeah, well, I do lectures in the medical school at Newcastle. So I will go and do this. And it's difficult too, because it's often to a room of white men, again, who push back against, what I'm saying, even if, you know, the sort of facts are quite apparent. And it's also a little unfortunate, because it's then the racialized groups that have to do the work. Right. So it's not only are they being negatively impacted by the context situation, but they have to do all the work to change those things, and often uncompensated. And so I do that. I think there are other ways. I know that there are reviews. I know that there are, you know, I see funding calls from like the NHS and different organizations to do, you know, work around policy change and education. And so, you know, they will call for a study to be done. So there's lots of studies being done, and there's a lot of articles being written, and there's a lot of training and retraining that's happening. I think it's an issue of uptake, that, you know, that it's really being put into practice. Mm-hmm. So I think the identification of the problem is very clear. And I think a lot of people sort of in policy and in health and in the medical community realize that this is a problem, but it's instituting those changes and the money that is required to do that, and the supports that are required, and the follow-up that's required. And I think, when you're constantly cutting, and you have this sort of austerity mindset when it comes to public goods, it becomes really difficult to make the business case for investment for protecting marginalized populations.
Yeah, I have to admit to being kind of a little bit in despair, because obviously there's the work that you've been doing around things like the pulse oximeters, and yet pulse oximeters are still being used, and they're still, as far as I'm aware, there hasn't been changes to the way in which the measurements are being taken, certainly not wide scale. I know there was something about the renal tests, and that actually the way that the calculation was done on that meant that if you were from a global majority population, then you would probably be diagnosed as being in the end stages of renal failure much later than if you were white. There was also something about, I've forgotten the name, but, you know, the thing that does your breath test.
Yeah, breathalyzer, yeah.
The way in that was measured in terms of lung capacity meant, again, because when they had been doing the test, they found, and I think this was in the States, they found that Black people had less lung capacity. And again, this goes to who's in the room.
Yeah.
They assumed that meant that Black people naturally had less lung capacity and therefore set the bar lower. They didn't go, oh, why did these people have a poorer lung capacity than these people? Let's look at the circumstances in which they live, because actually the lungs are pretty much the same.
And you know that was actually a kind of remnant from slavery, because when the argument was being made that Black people were inferior, lung capacity and less lung capacity was given in as an example.
Wow.
But it was like produced less lung capacity, right? And so that has sort of, and you know, when we talk about, you know, forgetting about slavery or colonialism, no, it's still, the impacts are still being felt now, because it's, you know, it's got such a long legacy that you still see it being used. And I think it's also, I did a little bit of work, I did a piece for ITV around medical training for testing for jaundice and low blood oxygen levels for infants, and the way in which the training manuals would tell them to look for discoloration and was just on white babies. And so it was impacting when jaundice was being identified or low blood oxygen was being tested for babies of color. So, you know, it still has its impact now.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, I saw something just last week about, I forgot which thing it was, but it was actually about assessing levels within women who recently given birth, and about, and so often it's students who are having to come up with these new metrics. This was a student midwife who had come up with new ways and was training people in how to recognize certain things in darker skinned women. It gives a little bit of hope, I suppose, that people are coming through and they're bringing and changing the way things are happening, but also that we're relying on students and not established staff to come up with this stuff. But
yeah, and the students should be learning at this point. They shouldn't sort of have to be, you know, doing this kind of reparative work of just like, you know, trying to mop up all of the problems that are there. But that student, you know, if you had people of color, you know, people who are disabled, you know, who are sexually minoritized in the room, making, you know, decisions and asking the questions that impact their communities, that is what is really required. And you need to have adequate funding for those people to do that kind of work and recognition of that kind of work as well. And I think that's really lacking. And it's not only just in kind of the medical community. I think it is along the lines of people working in the social sciences as well. It's those kinds of questions are not being asked. And so, you know, sometimes if you're in a room and you're the only woman of color there and you keep on having to put your hand up and say like, you know, what about, you know, you might want to think about this, and you sort of feel a little bit like, you know, you're the pestering one, you know, to bring up race and bring up gender and all of these other things. But it's the condition, you know, I found myself in. So it's like, okay, I'll just keep on doing it.
and you know what? I was having just that conversation with a doctor, female South Asian doctor, just yesterday. And just how, again, it does become weathering as well. But yeah. Tina, I could talk to you literally for hours, but we haven't got hours. So I just really want to thank you for that conversation. It's been kind of skimming across the surface of what I know is a really deep subject area, but I'd love to have more opportunities to talk to you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
I hope you've enjoyed that episode of Black All Year. It would be great if you could subscribe and review, because not only will it make sure that you get the content, but it'll help other people to find it too. Take care.